First Corinthians chapter 7. And coming now to this famous marriage chapter, the most important first statement on it must be that since the Corinthians asked Paul about marriage, some of its extreme statements need to be taken in the full context of the chapter for a balanced view of the subject. There is something like a perfect balance in the chapter if it is taken as a whole. And although Paul is plain in his personal preference for celibacy and his advocacy of it, as you have read, he does present marriage as the normal state for mankind. And a good job, too, if the human race is to survive and persist. Yet, in the context of Corinthian life and the Corinthian church's desire, which they had expressed to him that the apostle comment on the subject, he begins by dealing with it from a moral point of view, and that of the sins which can beset the married state, rather than dealing with it in the much higher ground he takes of marriage in Ephesians chapter 5, where he sees human marriage as the illustration of the heavenly state of Christ's marriage to his holy bride, the church. And that is beautifully set forth in the book of the Revelation, chapter 19. It is therefore important to see to it that we do not take Paul's first statements in response to their inquiry as the sum of what he thinks about marriage. He is dealing with a specific situation, which doubtless generally obtains, although as verse 26 states, he has a present distressful situation in mind which is unknown to us. But it is important, you see, to stress that the apostle here does not say the last word or even the highest word on marriage. To say that marriage is the divine resort for those who cannot contain is offered as a solution to the problem of sexual continence, not as the ideal of marriage. He is nearer the norm when he advises at verse 3 on the obligations of marriage with regard to cohabiting. There is a mutual obligation on husband and wife not to deprive each other of the benefit and pleasures afforded by marriage, namely total union. That's what marriage is, although the bodily is only part of it, and not necessarily the highest part. But it's essential. However, although in well-regulated marriages there may be periods of abstinence for one good reason or another, and Paul offers as an example the high reason of abstinence in the interest of prayer, even this has to be watched lest undue abstinence on the part of one partner causes Satan to step in and tempt the other, who, being unduly defrauded of conjugal rights, may look askance at someone else and be tempted to infidelity with another partner. But this, Paul says, is is by concession, not by command, since his own celibate position is clear. And although he does recommend celibacy as good in the present emergency, which he has in mind, whether he is thinking of an early return of the Lord or not, he does say in verse 29 that the time is short, whatever he means by that. We may therefore conclude that both Paul has a particular situation in mind, which need not always apply, and also he does not set forth his own preference for celibacy as a guide to others, who each, he says, has his and her own gift of God. If I may say so as a bachelor, and I've discussed this in my autobiography, which may be published by the end of the year, this is my own position, that although the Lord ordained celibacy for me, I do not recommend it, since the norm is marriage. And many indeed, think of what I was saying a moment ago about Sinclair and Dorothy, many of the highlights of my pastoral career have been the blessed marriages I have been involved with. Not a few couples sitting here tonight could stand to that testimony. I'm sure. Would you like to? Not tonight. Another time. If, on the other hand, God calls to celibacy, he will make it plain. I think we need, you know, to put Jesus' own word in here. When asked if on account of the hazards of marriage, it would be better not to marry. And Jesus, like Paul in his definitive statement Ephesians, uttered that wonderful word about eunuchs. You remember? Some, he said, some are born eunuchs. Some are made eunuchs by cruel and wicked men for vile purposes. And some choose virtual eunuchhood for the kingdom's sake. You can't legislate. It is a matter of individual calling. And for the Christian in particular, a matter, isn't it, of the will of God. And God's will for each of us may be very, very different. Paul then goes on from verse 10 to discuss marriage and divorce. Divorce is to be a very last resort. He offers what is regarded by Christian moralists as the second biblical ground for divorce. The first being, of course, as I said during the reading, as Jesus states in Matthew 19 and 9, in the exceptive clause, divorce for infidelity, that is, adultery. Here, the resolute departure of the other spouse is, as John Murray asserts in his essay on the subject, the resolute departure of the other spouse is a clear and adequate ground for divorce. But that is clearly on the ground of a departure from the faith, verse 15. And note in that connection that this is not permission to walk out on an unbelieving spouse. Paul makes that very plain. Every attempt within the marriage is to be made to win the other. But to accept the resolute departure of the unbelieving spouse on the grounds of lack of faith as an adequate ground for divorce. Paul then goes on from verse 17 to discuss vocation, calling. It is sometimes assumed, I don't know why, that only certain people like clergymen and other professionals have vocation. Not at all. Everyone has a vocation. Certainly this is true of Christians. We are called into his church and kingdom to serve. Paul discusses this under the particular case of circumcision, which became a great problem with Gentile believers, since the first Christians were, of course, circumcised Jews. Circumcision is a matter, he says, of the heart, as even the Old Testament tells us, Deuteronomy 30 and 6, and Jeremiah 9 and 25 and 26, both say that circumcision is a matter of the heart. The bodily act is, therefore, quite secondary. Keeping God's commandments from the heart is the thing. The apostle then goes on to discuss vocation in relation to slaves, of whom there were many in those days. Of course, it is good to be delivered from slavery, he says, and each slave should seek deliverance. But if it is not to be, then it is as possible to live as a Christian slave as a free man. Indeed, a Christian, although a slave, is a free man. And a Christian who is a free man is a love slave of Christ. So ultimately, it doesn't matter from the point of view of the Christian faith. Although the one state is infinitely desirable, more desirable than the other. Nonetheless, although Paul suggests that the slave may seek release, he goes on to say that every man should abide in the state in which he was called. Now, I was wondering what some of you were thinking about that when we were reading it. It seems a very absolute statement. It's certainly a very general statement, which obviously allows exceptions. And I know of many exceptions myself. God-given exceptions, indeed, in the lives of some dear folk I've known. But the advice, you see, is particularly good in the initial stages of newborn Christianity, when one is newly born of God. For the radicalness of the change, you see, when one is born of God, which may take place after conversion, may tempt a person rashly to upbraid and give up all his or her former life. No, says Paul. Why, the very reason one is converted in one's present situation may be to witness to Christ just where you are, in your home or at your work or wherever. Which would be defeated if, for example, everyone who found Christ was expected almost automatically to go into what is called full-time Christian service. That would simply eject people from their legitimate sphere of influence. There is a notion, you know, amongst worldly people, in their ignorance, that when a man or a woman gets religion, they are fit for nothing but a religious vocation. That would deprive the secular world of all witness to Jesus Christ, wouldn't it? Indeed, a calling to the ministry following conversion or consecration has to be monitored with great restraint to make sure that it is not a romantic notion engendered, possibly even by the enemy, to mislead souls. into a false vocation to which they were not called. Some have made shipwreck of their lives because they romantically thought they were called to the Lord's service, and it never worked out. Paul returns at verse 25 to the subject of whether one should marry, and he discusses it in relation to the present emergency, whatever emergency that was. We don't know, except that it may have been that there was a sense of urgency that the coming of the Lord was near, and believers should have been looking to that divine event and not to be obsessed with thoughts of perpetuating their earthly situation and its pleasures. Many scholars think Paul was decidedly mistaken about the imminent coming of the Lord. Well, he hasn't come yet, and that's a long time since Paul, isn't it? But they forget. Wonder what you think about this. They forget that when the Spirit of God is actively at work in a community, and believers are making considerable headway and advance in their relationships with the Lord, and when in worship and in prayer there is a pregnant sense of the Lord's presence, there could grow in that atmosphere a sense of imminency developing, when it was easy to believe that the Lord was at the very door and would be here in a day or two, or tomorrow, or even tonight. I'm sure that many, quite innocently, have mistaken the wonderful sense of the Lord's presence by his Holy Spirit as an intimation that he was just at the door and would be here within hours or days. I'm not saying that that's the full explanation of this, but it's very important to understand it. And of course there are Christians who are on the fringe of the Christian church, who never allow themselves to be in a spirit of profound worship and prayer, who would have no sense of this at all. They would never have a sense of the imminency of the Lord's coming, because they don't feel him very near anyway. And maybe don't want him to be too near, alas. The apostle now prefaces an important section of the chapter with a comment, verse 28, that marriage will bring troubles. He then goes on to speak in general about how Christians should live in detachment from exigent things and times, urgent, emergent things and times. And I want to say about these verses from 29 to 35, I count these verses among the most important, and certainly as far as my ministry all the years I've been here, I have found them to be amongst the most important and practical verses in the New Testament. I must have applied these scores and surely hundreds of times to individual lives and to human situations. The theme is what I call detachment, which is the secret for the avoidance of that stress and strain which leads to what people now call burnout. And this, if I may say so again, is not unrelated to the theme of the booklet and the bookstall, Rhythms of Rest and Work. In a time and strain, when, as Paul says, the time may be short, the apostle suggests that those who have wives should live as though they had none. What on earth does he mean? Well, the same applies to those who mourn, or those who rejoice, or those who buy, or those who use the things of this world. Now, let's tackle the subject from the point of view of all this list. Take the first one about marriage, and we can apply it to the others, to mourning, or rejoicing, or buying, or possessing. You see? You apply it as you need. Yes, tackle it from the point of view of those who have wives. The apostle can hardly mean that a husband treats his wife as if she weren't there. As a Christian, he should treat her better, not worse. But you see, the matter is not primarily of how he treats her, which, as a Christian, should be with the greatest care and affection, but how in his heart he regards her. That's very different. In fact, he must lay her on the altar of that sacrifice, which ought to be the worshipping shrine of those committed to Christ. Or put it another way, he must give her to Christ in the sense that Christ, to him, must be first. And she second. I sometimes say to believing couples at their marriage that if they want their union to be fully blessed by God, the Lord Jesus Christ must stand between them, not to separate them, but he must stand between them so that he is first to both of them. This will not separate them from each other, for Christ will bind them closer to each other than they could ever achieve by mere human affection and striving. This is something that only Jesus Christ can do by coming between them and causing them to love him first, so that they each love one another more than they could ever do without Jesus. I almost expect to hear some amens at that point. I expect you're saying them inwardly. I hope you are. If not, you better come and see me. The same applies to joy and sorrow, to buying and to using the things of this world. Detachment from all but Christ. Christ first. A Scots preacher used to put it like this, that we should let the things of this world hang slack about us. Now, that's much harder to do. I mean, to be detached from something or someone one keeps than to be detached from someone or something one gives up and surrenders. Do you see that? I better say that again. I hope you take that in. That's very important. Much harder to be detached from something you have than from something you give up. It's in that situation, you see, that the wife of your bosom, the husband of your bosom, is next to Jesus. Paul goes on to say that a married man is naturally taken up with the things which pertain to his wife, and vice versa, the wife with her husband. But you see, in view of what he has just said, and we've to take the whole chapter in context, it is clear that if there is real detachment from preoccupation with one's spouse, then that aspect of life is kept in its proper place. And so Paul goes on to say that he is not saying this, verse 35, in order to impose restrictions upon anyone. That's a very healthy thing for him to say in view of some of the extreme statements in the chapter. But he's saying this to ensure that nothing interferes with devotion to the Lord. For if we're out of step with the Lord, nothing will go right with the marriage or with anything else, business or whatever. He must be first if life is to be lived at its best. We'll come back to that later on. The chapter ends with this intriguing advice to those intent upon getting married and to those under no compulsion to get married at a time of distress. What the distress is must surely be something much more certain than the expected coming of the Lord, as some suggest. It must have been something exceedingly assured and pressing to cause the apostle to give such emphatic counsel, don't you think? He obviously thinks it is better not to marry in those circumstances, whatever they were. But you see, we have no means of knowing what they were. And then he comes to the final sentences about the right of the bereaved spouse to marry again. But of course, only in the Lord. But again he advises, better not, without giving his reason, except that he feels he has the Spirit of God and is saying those things in accordance with what the Spirit of the Lord Jesus would say and do if we asked him. But be all that as it may, it seems to me the most generally useful counsel in this chapter is in these verses 29 to 35, which concern our attitude not only to husband and wife, but to every other earthly matter, all of which can be very simply stated, and as I said, in the spirit of the booklet, Rhythms of Rest and Work. For the way to live is to be so completely thoroughed, bound, tied to the Lord, that no one and nothing can come between you and him. And if I discuss this a little more in terms of the subject of marriage, it will be easy for you to apply that simple but thoroughgoing principle that he enunciates, to apply it to anything else in all the world, whether a career, or a property, or an appetite. But you see, it might be thought impossible to treat a wife properly if one preserves an attitude of complete detachment from her. But you know, the opposite is actually the case. It depends, of course, upon what you mean by detachment. It is a matter of seeing her through the eyes of Jesus Christ, which means that you will do everything right by her as Jesus would do. And that couldn't be bad or wrong, could it? And yet, the spouse will never be dominant in the partner's life. But he, the Lord, will always be the dominant one. But he will be for the one spouse through the other, each serving the other. That's love. Love is giving. Love is serving. Too many people think of love as taking, snatching, rapaciously. That's not love, that's lust. Love is giving. Yeah. So it is bound to be better for each, putting Christ first and laying the other or whatever else on the altar, than it would be otherwise. Now, what do you think of all that? I'm wondering what you're thinking of it all. Here's an idea. You sometimes see a double picture on television, or if you have, unfortunately, superimposed one picture on top of another, you may see a dominant figure and behind it another figure. Well, although that's an accident, I suppose, as far as taking photographs is concerned, but it will be deliberate when you see it sometimes in television. That's how it ought to be with everyone and everything in our lives. See everyone and everything through Jesus, with his eyes. That's the way to live. And don't you think it's a wonderful way to live? Oh, absolutely ideal. The highest, the best. It means that absolutely everything is invested in Jesus Christ. Whatever you have, whatever you own. And he, being more safe than many houses, there's nothing in the wide world to worry about, because with him in your sights and controlling all else, everything finds its proper place and its true level and has its due and proper emphasis. The whole of life behind him finds its proper place and is set in its proper order. He'll do that. Let him manage your life and see how he rearranges the rest of it. I say rearranges, for you sure see a better way of doing it than you do. Perhaps John 12:24 says it all in other language. You remember that verse? Except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it remains alone. But if it dies, it produces much fruit. This is part of that, you see. For the dying is not negative. The planting of the seed and its rotting in the ground, that's not negative, although it may seem so. But it is a matter of yielding everything to Jesus Christ and letting him control your whole life. And nothing could be more practical than applying that to married life, or to matters of rejoicing. Be detached from your joy. Be detached from your sorrow. Be detached from your buying, whether it's houses or whatever, or motor cars or such like. and holding on to things, anything, not holding on to them as if you had a right to keep them forever, as if you had an undying and inalienable right to them. We have only, as fallen human beings, we have only one legitimate right. And you know what it is? It's hell. That's the only thing we have a right to. Hell. All beyond that is a bonus. Is bonus. And those who live as Spartan as that see everything, even a cup of cold water, as a bonus. You know, you will sometimes find a tramp on the highway, the happiest of men, because he hasn't a care in the world. And if he happens to be a Christian tramp, and he may well be, somebody scunnered with what we call civilization, he will have a carrier for all his troubles. And the carrier is Jesus Christ. This is the way to live, which seems so negative, but cannot be negative if he is in it, if he is at the heart of it. How can it be negative? Because even when he's being negative with a view to being positive. He died to rise again, didn't he? We've had great fun, Sheena Brown and I, over a title for this old autobiography that I'm sick to death of. And I had an inspiration one day. I said, well, here's a phrase that I've often used. What will it do? And she liked it. I hope the publishers like it too. You know what it is? The way up is down. That says it all, doesn't it? The way up is down. Now we usually sing hymn number 422, Jesus, the very thought of thee with sweetness fills my breast. This is the same hymn by the same writer, Sir St. Bernard of Clairvaux, but it's translated by a different man. It's translated here, 421, by John Mason Neal. And it's a beautiful hymn, and we'll sing it to the tune of Ben's. 421, Jesus, the very thought is sweet.